I've never visited a house that overawed me in its size or opulence. I'm sure they're out there. Living so close to Washington, D.C., I've visited Mount Vernon, home of Washington, and Monticello, home of Thomas Jefferson, but they were farmers, among other things, and their houses aren't that imposing. Standing inside them, you might even call them cozy. I also lived in Kentucky and visited Ashland, the home of Henry Clay, another farmer politician. It was a little more lavish. I guess the closest I've come so far to seeing a real showplace was Casa Loma in Toronto. It really impressed me. Now and again, I see it pop up in movies. It was used as the interior of the Xavier School for Mutants in X-Men. The paneled interior was also the law offices of Billy Flynn in the movie Chicago. You could say the exterior of Casa Loma has a cameo in Scott Pilgrim. The house is high on a hill, and the railed stairs leading up to Casa Loma from the city contribute to the death of one of the League of Evil exes. Besides the terrific paneled walls throughout Casa Loma, there was one room that definitely spoke to me. It was the windowed interior garden with a stained glass ceiling. Nice. I once drew up a sketch of my dream house, and it had a feature something like that. I can think of some nice fictional houses that are so central to the narrative that they almost seem real. Pemberley is the prize in Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Here's a little quote. Its banks were neither formal nor falsely adorned. Elizabeth was delighted. She had never seen a place where nature had done more, or where natural beauty had been so little counteracted by an awkward taste. They were all of them warm in her admiration, and at that moment she felt that to be the mistress of Pemberley might be something. The next fictional house I can't name because it's part of the secret book movie we will be quizzing you about in the upcoming CNV movie quiz. But here's a short description of my own. There's a long drive up to the house. The woods all around obscure the house from the road. The place is somewhat remote. It's out in the country. The woods are full of wild rhododendrons and bluebells. If you walk from the back of the place and follow either of two paths, you'll find yourself down by a cove that gives way to the ocean. Inside the manor are many rooms. A master staircase joins the upstairs and the downstairs. At the top and to the side of these stairs is a musician's gallery. The place is so large it has an east and west wing, but only the west wing has a full view of the ocean. This estate is nice and creepy compared to Pemberley. And third on my list of nice fictional houses is one everyone remembers, Xanadu. It was a nice prison for two.
The march of time.
Legendary was Xanadu, where Kublai Khan decreed his stately pleasure dome. Today, almost as legendary is Florida's Xanadu, world's largest private pleasure ground. Here on the deserts of the Gulf Coast, a private mountain was commissioned and successfully built. 100,000 trees, 20,000 tons of marble are the ingredients of Xanadu's mountain. Contents of Xanadu's palace, paintings, pictures, statues, the very stones of many other palaces. A collection of everything so big it can never be cataloged or appraised. Enough for 10 museums, the loot of the world. Xanadu's livestock, the fowl of the air, the fish of the sea, the beasts of the field and jungle. Two of each, the biggest private zoo since Noah. Like the pharaohs, Xanadu's landlord leaves many stones to mark his grave. Since the pyramid, Xanadu is the costliest monument a man has built to himself. Here in Xanadu last week, Xanadu's landlord was laid to rest. A potent figure of our century, America's Kublai Khan, Charles Foster Kane.
Time marches on.
I'd like to start this show with a bit of a new feature. We'll call it Statements of the Obvious. The adverts at the end of the recent episodes are not real. We're tying them into the show themes. For example, somewhere in this show there'll be a cigarette commercial, but it isn't a cigarette that exists out there any longer. And besides the point, we don't promote smoking. It dulls the taste buds, and of course, it gives you the big C. Recently, I was standing next to a young man at my train stop, and he was using a device that he apparently was smoking. The smoke or vapor smelled like vanilla or baked goods. I asked him a series of quick questions about his smoking inhaler, and he sounded a little like it would still be a problem for a person's lungs, because he compared it to breathing on a very humid day. It certainly didn't look cool, like real cigarettes do. It looked very dweeby, like a Bluetooth headset. Okay, another statement of the obvious. The last episode, there wasn't enough number 11. But we can fix that. But first, here's a word from our new sponsor. Not a real sponsor.
If you have a taste for luxury, do say Du Maurier, when only the best will do. Du Maurier's extraordinary tobaccos age 4 years in wooden casks, maturing slowly, leisurely. They are never roused from their slumber till they reach the mellow age of distinction. This longer aging gives you a mellowness in smoking you could never experience until now. Full king size, filter tip, full flavor. Du Maurier. If your dealer does not have Du Maurier, do ask him to order them today. Du Maurier Cigarettes, a product of Brown & Williamson Tobacco Corporation.
Coming up next, the juicy truth with number 11 and Rotwang.
Today I'm joined by my sister, B12. It's been so long.
Hi.
Where have you been?
Michigan.
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 Do you remember the last show we did together? What we were drinking or anything about
yeah,
it?
Yeah, we did Three Sisters, I think, or Middle Sister.
And okay. We liked it, right?
And we liked it, yeah.
That was Rebel Rebel. So this is my sister, B12, and she brought her significant other with her this evening. Hi, Tim.
Hello. I feel honored.
And tonight we are drinking a Merlot. This Merlot is called Widow's Walk.
It's a black bottle with a black label, which makes it very unique, Widow's Walk, and it has the...
What is a Widow's Walk? I don't know if everyone knows that what that is.
Well, a Widow's Walk is a little area... kind of at the top of a cupola or on the top floor of a house that has a door and a small walking area, usually looking out to the sea when the women were waiting for their men to come home. And a lot of the men didn't make it home, so you could be a widow out there.
It's like an architectural feature to a house,
yes.
Right? And I guess if you call it a widow's walk, I guess, yeah, that kind of implies... Hope you didn't make it home.
You might be a widow.
You might be a widow if. Yeah. It's interesting. And I think labels do wonders for having people buy them.
You bring that up now. It's funny because I don't, you know, it's not a happy looking label at all. And talking about widows is kind of depressing. You know, it's got death. It's got death built into the wine bottle. Basically, it's a little strange as a choice. But
mystery would pull you in.
Exactly. You know, if you're into mysteries, I think that the wine label is something that, you know, it looks like a mystery novel type image. Okay, well, let's get right into the review then. And what we begin with is the color.
It's black and white.
Right.
No, that's
are we reviewing the movie or the wine?
No, not the wine. Oh. The wine. So you're looking through the wine and it's very dark.
This is a garnet.
Yeah, I would say it's blood red.
Blood red.
Yeah. Ooh, blood red.
Well, we're being dark, aren't we?
Right.
I was going to say, this is definitely a blood red.
Tim.
A 10 is good, Tim.
10 is fine.
You like that color?
9.5 to 10.
9.5. Okay.
Clarity.
Is that an automatic 10?
Body.
The body is the viscosity.
You it's resistance to flow. That's viscosity.
I like that.
I was going to say, you can say that out loud. He'll use it.
Yeah, please do. And jump in with anything technical. But unless this was like maple syrup or something, it's really hard to tell. Like, is this thicker, say, than some other wine? Another thing you can do is look at the legs where you swirl it in your glass and the tears come down. If they come down slowly and you can see them, that would mean that there's more alcohol in the wine and bigger body then. Can you see the tears?
Yeah, I saw the tears coming down, but I don't have a fast wine to compare it to.
I understand. It's another judgment call. You'd have to have a bunch of different types of wine that had a big difference between them to see any difference.
But it does hang up there a little bit.
Yeah, they hang up there.
That's what they call legs. I didn't know that for a long time.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever had that in a podcast before.
I guess to judge this on body, it should be somewhere between a Pinot and a Cab, and I think it is.
I agree. And I think that you could have it with your dinner.
You could have it with your meal.
You could have it with your meal, and I don't think it would take away from your meal.
So I think it should get, you know, pretty high points for body. 10 or 9.
I'm good with that.
9.
Aroma notes. Okay, now we should take
deep breaths.
Deep breaths. Swirling is good, and putting your nose right down in the glass is good.
And very smoky.
I agree. I was getting a kind of woody, smoky.
Do you ever go so far as to find out, like, if it's a medium toast or a... how does that work, hon? I can't remember. The toasting of the barrel is...
I mean, there's different oaks. They make them out of them. Most of them are French oak, or there's medium toast, or use them for a couple different campaigns of wine, and then they may switch, you know, casks.
The podcast right before this one talks about toast. We were talking about a Chardonnay, about burning the inside of the staves of the barrel, and that's what the toast is. Basically, what they tell you is what type of oak they are using. They have different outcomes. American oak is harsher than French oak. It's a little bit smoother.
The French oak has less tannic acid in it, and it's a smoother taste.
Tim, did you realize that they have little pieces of oak that they actually float when they're fermenting some wines? They'll just dump in like little squares of oak and let it float around in the wine for a while.
No.
Before they put it in the cask.
Right.
No, I didn't know that. A lot of times now the Chardonnays, they're using stainless tanks so they don't get that oaky, earthy, smoky flavor in the Chardonnay wines.
There's kind of like competing versions of how a Chardonnay should actually taste. And this other school of thought is that, no, it shouldn't be influenced by oak. And they're using like unoaked. You might see that on a label, unoaked.
We drink those.
Because
container, and it tastes a lot different.
We have several wineries up in Michigan that do the unoaked. Did you know that on the actual cask, there's like the coating? Somebody just recently showed us that there will be like an MT on the cask. That's medium toast, or just toasted was just tea, and where the oak was from, like the French oak or something. There's a label on it. You can just read the numbers right across it if you know what they mean.
And the year it was made.
And the year it was made.
That's cool.
I feel we need a bit of station identification put in right here. We are reviewing Widow's Walk Merlot.
Yeah, but sometimes I feel like a Merlot smells like dirt or earthy.
Uh-huh.
And I wouldn't put this one there.
No.
Just, it's overwhelmingly smoky.
I agree, it's smoky. I think I taste some wood in there. Well, do you like it?
Yeah, you know, if you're even talking about pairing, I can see this going with a salmon. It would go really great with a salmon cooked on the grill or pork because of the smokiness, and you could do it with the barbecue type thing.
Mm-hmm.
We bought a red that was smoky like this recently, and I can guarantee you that it wouldn't have been a Merlot. But I was trying to think of what it was.
Number 9 and I, one of our favorite wines was from South Africa, and it was a Pinotage, and it was smoky and sweet, and it was like, oh, so good.
Really? Because we recently had a South African wine, and we thought it tasted like communion wine with no alcohol content.
But it made a real nice oil candle.
Yes, we turned it into a lamp. Nice shape of a bottle. But we didn't feel that it was that great of a wine.
Please relate that story again about the lady with the super palate. That sounds great.
She felt that she could pick out. She was picking out all the flavors. You know, whether it were pear or whether something was, you know, buttery or the smoothness of it and pineapple,
peaches. Or
did she perform with her super palate right in front of you, naming more than 4 flavors in a wine or anything like that?
It's been a little while, but she did name them off, but she could have easily just read them off.
She was
basically
blindfolded.
Bullying us.
Okay, well, anyway, I just like the concept of the super palate, and I'm going to use it from now on. I definitely do not have the super palate. I don't know anyone with the super palate yet, but I'm hoping to meet them.
Okay. Tim says I have a super palate, so your B12 has a super palate.
Nice to meet you there.
Thank you. I don't claim it often.
Okay, so.
And I haven't been able to pick out 4 things in a wine, that's for sure.
So I would give this pretty high points for aroma. What do you think?
Yeah, it's got a very bold aroma. 9.
Give it a 9.
9?
Taste notes.
I would say that this isn't, it's not flat, which is good, and it's not acidy to me.
Not at all.
And it's not bitter. We have to name it something. It's
really, because I balanced.
I'd say mild or something.
I think it's kind of a balance because it's got a finish on it that doesn't really linger. I know you're going to do alcohol later, but it doesn't leave that
aftertaste.
Sometimes, I mean, I've had some wines that are slightly bitter and I like go for that. And sometimes I have some wines that are lemony, kind of acidy, that kind of way, and I go for that. But this is neither of those things, and I still like it. It's like you said, it's somewhere falling in between all of those places. It's making a good balance of all of them. It makes it harder to talk about, of course.
I was trying to reach for any type of wine grape flavor or anything, and I can't really pinpoint other than that, you know, smoky flavor that you're getting.
This might be your favorite Merlot, though, right? Because it doesn't taste that much more like a Merlot.
We're not big Merlot drinkers, so.
If you would have handed this to me and told me to taste it, I wouldn't have said it was a Merlot. I probably would have said it was a Cab.
Yeah.
It's a lighter wine than a Cab.
Both of you, Tim and B12, are into sweeter wines. What do you think of the sweetness? Would you say, yeah, this is okay, but I'd just rather have a sweet wine right now?
you can taste a wine, and a dry wine will just like clip off or something. I don't know how to say it. It's just like poof, the finish, and it's gone and it's dry.
Mm-hmm.
And this one doesn't do that. This one is dry. It definitely lingers.
Lingers
with you.
On.
Maybe your tongue is filling in a little sweetness because it's got a long finish. Your tongue doesn't know what to make of it, and I say, well, why not say sweet?
I don't think I'd ever call it sweet, but I don't think I would call it. I don't think I'd really call it dry. It's not a semi-sweet.
A lot of wines are classified as fruity, and which is not necessarily a sweet quality. I wouldn't call it fruity, would you?
No.
Do you like this flavor, or do you not?
I'm giving it a 5 because as far as reds go, I like that it lingers a little bit with you. It's not that dry that it just clips off.
I'd probably rate it an 8.
He likes red wine.
Well, I'm not a big red wine drinker, but for a Merlot, I like this. Mm-hmm. It has a lingering taste and it's not as dry, and I enjoyed that more, so...
Are you going with 8?
Yeah, I would go with an 8.
Complexity or structure?
Complexity for us is if there's lots of things going on with the wine and that we can actually name. Like spices.
Yes.
Flavors, smells, and if there's more than one or two
so
or three.
So this isn't very complex,
no.
Then.
No. So we're gonna have to say that this is going to be a low category.
Like a 2?
Oh, well, that's a pretty darn low.
It's not really a negative quality.
No, I've never opened my wallet far enough to buy a super expensive wine, but I assume that they are more complex than like a $10 bottle of wine. 2 is totally acceptable score.
Acid balance.
And I think this is a very balanced kind of wine, don't you? I feel this has got a good balance.
Yes, it is not flat, and it's not acidy where you could say, oh, I taste acid. It's in the zone for acid. I'm going to say 9 at least.
I would give it an 8 or a 9.
I'm with them. 9.
Alcohol balance?
Well, now, see, I don't feel... You said it was a 13% alcohol, which is typical 13 to 13.5, but this one, to me, doesn't feel, like, terribly strong.
Yeah.
Which goes back to balance again, that you don't feel like you're... Whew.
This category is an easy category because some wines are all about the alcohol and you get this wall of alcohol hitting you in the face. And that means that it's out of balance. You don't taste any flavor.
I'd probably rate it an 8.
Price.
Okay, so the perfect bottle of wine, as we've set it up, is $10 or below. So this is over that.
Well, you know what? If you're thinking that the quality of the wine that you get increases with the price, this one was a very balanced wine in a lot of our categories that we had.
Would you buy it again?
I'm not a Merlot drinker, but if I knew that I was going to visit friends that drank Merlot, I think that I would probably pick this one. I would drink this one again, which I guess in turn would say that I would probably buy it again. I guess you got to give it an 8 then, don't you?
Okay, 8 sounds okay to me.
Woohoo!
The final score, 82. Not too bad.
I'm pretty impressed at an 82% for a Merlot. And I am B12.
So she knows what she's talking about.
That's right. It's been a pleasure. Tim, do you have anything to add?
Peace out.
Now let's answer the big question of what was the movie and book for the last episode, episode 22. The clip was called Escorting Evelyn. And here is a little reminder of what that sounded like.
Are you some kind of a lunatic now?
I'm sorry, I'm acting like one, aren't I? You should see me at the office. I am really not like this. So what do you say? Do you have some free time?
Well, maybe.
The answer is, of course, ragtime. The film was released in 1981. It was directed by Milos Forman. It starred Elizabeth McGovern, Brad Dourif, Mandy Patinkin, Mary Steenburgen. It had small parts for author Norman Mailer and veteran film stars Pat O'Brien, Donald O'Connor, and my favorite, James Cagney. The book Ragtime was published in 1974, and the author was E.L. Doctorow. I first read it in college. It was the first book of historical fiction I read, and I have to say I'm a fan of this type of book that mixes real historical people into a fictional story. The book has more historical characters in it than the movie. The book gives us portraits of J.P. Morgan, Henry Ford, and Emma Goldman. The book also has Harry Houdini in it as a speaking character. The film just shows Houdini in silent movie newsreels with title cards. In that same scene, we're introduced to Coalhouse Walker, the man who winds up being the central figure in the movie plot. He's shown playing his piano underneath the newsreels. The movie eventually focuses on the Coalhouse Walker story of racism and radical redemption. But Doctorow gives the novel no central storyline. It's written in third person, and I started to wonder who was speaking if not the author, because instead of character names, Doctorow uses family titles for many of the characters. He talks about a family in New Rochelle, New York, and only tells us that she is called Mother, he is called Father, the brother to Mother is called Younger Brother throughout the book. There's also a little boy and grandfather. We also meet an immigrant family who are called Tata and Mama, which are the Yiddish titles father and mother. They also have a little girl. The book can cover more territory than the movie with its characters. For example, Father goes with Perry to the North Pole. Younger Brother becomes a rebel and fights with Zapata. The author's voice feels third person limited, but is really omniscient, meaning the teller of the story knows everything. The terrain of the book is mostly covered by Younger Brother's experiences, but it goes off every now and again, leaving him behind. Younger Brother is played by Brad Dourif in the movie, who was Doc Cochran on the HBO series Deadwood. He was also one of the featured voices in the clip we used. He was the stalker of Evelyn Thaw. I have a few quotes from the book Ragtime. She led Younger Brother around the Lower East Side in a futile search for Tata and the little girl. The flat on Hester Street had been abandoned. Evelyn took up the lease and paid the landlord for the pitiful furnishings. She spent hours sitting by the window on the air shaft. She would touch things, a blanket, a plate, like a blind person trying to read with her fingers. Then she would break down and be soothed by Mother's Younger Brother in the narrow brass bed. A very cool part of the book is when Houdini is put into a cell across the way from Thaw, who was very wealthy and quite nuts. Houdini escaped from actual prison cells as part of his publicity-making routine. The prisoners watch each other to pass the time. Here's a quote from the book about Houdini. Houdini was a headliner in the top vaudeville circuits. His audiences were poor people, carriers, peddlers, policemen, children. His life was absurd. He went all over the world accepting all kinds of bondage and escaping. People who did not respond to his art profoundly distressed Houdini. He had come to realize they were invariably the upper classes. Always they broke through the pretense of his life and made him feel foolish. The book wades into the subjects of class, women's rights, and racism. The movie skirts most of the classism in women's rights and focuses mainly on racism. Racism creates the necessary story conflict to carry you through the second half of the film. Without it, you might have another movie, one starring Evelyn Nesbit or Evelyn Thaw. They already made a film of just her story called The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing. I haven't seen that film from 1955, but it's out there. I'm much more interested in the Thaw scandal parts of Ragtime than the rest. Evelyn was a real person, and you can find many photos of her in the Library of Congress print archive. The album art for last episode is a photo of Evelyn from the archive. I colorized it. When I began describing the chapter, escorting Evelyn, and editing the Francis Ford Coppola wine review, I began to think that you might get confused that the answer would be Godfather 2, because there are some tenement scenes in that film. Some of Milos Forman's other films are One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus, Man on the Moon, and The People vs. Larry Flint. That's a pretty good string. Speaking of prolific directors, the director of this episode's chapter and verse was very celebrated and made a long string of iconic and popular films. So let's jump to the next movie chapter quiz, shall we? Now it's time for the chapter and verse quiz for episode 22. This chapter is called A Change in Demeanor, and it's 4 minutes and 25 seconds long. It's in black and white, but we aren't supplying any more hints at this time. Here we go. The first shot is that of a monogrammed address book. It lays on a writing desk on top of a clean blotter. In front of the desk is a porcelain inkwell set. There's a shadow cast across the desktop and the address book. The camera pivots 180 degrees from the book to the person sitting at the desk. It's a young woman. She appears to be in some distress. Her head bobs about. She looks confused. Her mouth is held somewhat between a forced smile and a grimace. Her hands strain to support herself at the desk. She looks at the address book with fear and catches her breath, controlling her need to cry. She clenches and unclenches her hands a few times and quickly flips the address book over so that the monogram faces down. She reaches out to a fancy phone. It's an antique type of phone with a porcelain base decorated with a floral applique. It has no dials or numbers on it, but a row of 6 buttons. There's a cut to a close-up of the woman. We now see tears in her eyes. She speaks into the phone and asks for a servant to come to her. A tear rolls down her cheek. We hear the phone receiver replaced in the cradle. At this point, I want to name this woman, but I can't. She has no name. For convenience, I will call her by the title Modesty. The camera pulls away and Modesty seems to have pulled herself together. She moves a stack of papers from the center of the desk, pulls open the top desk drawer towards her ribs, and tosses a pile of letters on the table. Many are tied into neat packets with ribbons. She pushes the stacks away and finds a single card. There's an insert shot of an invitation. Modesty's thumbs turn the card. The RSVP is written on the invite down in the lower corner in a loopy calligraphy. It reads, "I'll be there and how," and it's signed Jack. The film cuts to Modesty. Her mouth opens a bit and her brows rise as she contemplates the card. But there isn't time for more. She dries her tears with her fingers quickly and looks straight ahead. A dark, slim figure strides mechanically into the room. Her white hands are held locked together at the base of her ribs. She wears a long black dress. It's the blackest thing in the movie. That's why We will call her Ms. Vader. Ms. Vader looks like she may be in mourning. Her hair is braided tight and high. In this scene, as she enters, we hear an almost inaudible sound of heels clump once, then twice, and silence as she reaches the carpet. The camera dollies along with Vader as she crosses the elaborate room. Vader speaks. "You wanted to see me, madam." She stands at the front of the desk. Two large candelabras are positioned at the corners of the desk. Modesty stands up to meet Vader and says, "Yes, Miss Vader, I want you to get rid of all these things." With this, Modesty makes a gesture with her head. It isn't clear if she means the letters on the desk or everything in the room. The servant, Vader, seems rather shocked and corrects her mistress. "But these are Mrs. Departed's things." "I am Mrs. Departed now," Modesty states forcefully. There is an orchestral flourish on the soundtrack to underscore this change in demeanor. In this shot, Vader is framed between the candelabras. This shot is either very low from the desktop upwards, or the desktop is a movie magic false top raised high to show both the desk and Miss Vader. In either case, the shot is seriously composed. In the lower left corner of the frame is the address book. It has magically moved to be upright so the monogram is plainly visible. It seems propped against the stack of letters. Centered in front of Vader is a figurine. It may be a figure of a courtier in a doublet who's chasing a lover through the woods. A car horn sounds two times. The ladies turn away from each other, and the camera follows Modesty as she goes to the tall curtained windows and looks out. She turns back to Vader and says, "Just a moment, please." She crosses the room to stand in front of Vader. She continues by explaining she will not speak of an earlier visit to the estate by a rude friend of Vader's. She says, "In fact, I prefer to forget everything that happened this afternoon." The two face each other, both with their hands clasped together in front of them. On the table behind Vader is a vase holding large lilies. There's a huge shadow cast on the wall by the flowers. Again, this is intentional by the director, because a shadow this large and cast in this way would mean a great light source coming from the floor. The flowers seem to spring from Vader, and the shadow reaches towards Modesty like a rake. Modesty turns abruptly and leaves Vader standing in the room. There's a cut to Vader standing center frame in the room. The lighting has changed. The room is much darker. One candelabra is silhouetted at Vader's left shoulder. It looks like a pitchfork. A slight smile plays at the corners of Vader's mouth. It gives her a look of knowing or defiance. I'm going to abbreviate the next bit. Modesty's husband has returned. She runs to meet him, throws her arms about his neck, and he spins her around. They walk from the grand hallway into a smaller room. He lights his pipe while listening to her plans for a party. He's not enthusiastic, but consents, as long as she realizes it will mean a great effort. Again, she hugs his neck and he kisses her on the cheek. Here's a clip of the exchange between Modesty and her husband, Mr. Departed.
Please, darling, could we?
You don't know what it would mean, you know. You would have to be a hostess to hundreds of people. All the county. And a lot of young people would come up from London and turn the house into a nightclub.
Oh, yes, but I want to. Oh, please. I've never been to a large party, but I could learn what to do. And I promise you, you wouldn't be ashamed of me.
As if to depict the joy of Modesty to have her husband home and a brand new purpose, the director moves from the insert of a sketch pad to a bright and airy shot of Modesty studiously working on another drawing. The shot is a close-up and it isn't clear where she's at. There's a knock and Modesty calls out that the visitor should come in. Modesty sits on her bed facing the door as Vader enters the room. The bedroom is filled with flower arrangements. Vader walks forward to Modesty's bed. Modesty stays seated there. She holds her sketch pencil in her lap, pointing out towards Vader. Vader approaches, holding several sheets of white paper in front of her chest. The way Vader holds the sheets with both hands stiffly forward makes them appear like a shield or a flag of truce. The camera cuts to behind Modesty and focuses on Vader, an over-the-shoulder shot. Far behind Vader is a vase of flowers. There's a tremendous shadow being cast by the vase upward towards the ceiling. It's noteworthy because we've seen the light source for this room. It's a large bank of windows that parallels the bed. The light should stream from the background to the front. There's no way the flowers could cast shadows straight up. This begs the question, why? Only a minute ago in the writing room, we saw a similar arrangement of a looming shadow over flowers cast behind Vader. Vader is repeatedly shown framed in an unreal shadow. It follows her. It gives her power and malevolence. Vader smiles and says, "Robert found these sketches in the library. Did you intend to throw them away?" Modesty replies, "Yes, Miss Vader, I did. They were just some ideas I was sketching for my costume for the ball." Vader asks, "Hasn't Mr. Departed suggested anything?" Modesty shares, "No, I want to surprise him. I don't want him to know anything about it." Modesty gives a little look of warning. Vader continues, "I merely thought you might find a costume among the family portraits that might suit you." "You mean the ones at the top of the stairs?" Modesty confirms. "I'll go and look at them." She turns to go. Vader waits a few steps and then follows. The scene changes to the upper hall. The stair rail is in the foreground, and the back walls are divided into bays by large ceiling buttresses. Between the buttresses are hanging large life-size portraits. They pass by one painting. Modesty hesitates and scratches her head. "This one, for instance, might have been designed for you," says Vader. "I'm sure you could have it copied. I've heard Mr. Departed say it's his favorite of all the paintings." Modesty twists around and smiles at Vader. She twists back and looks at the portrait of a young woman in a flouncy, bell-shaped dress. The dress is worn off the shoulder with a decorative flower of fabric at the waist. The woman also wears a wide-brimmed sunbonnet. Modesty folds her arms and continues to think about the dress. She says, "That's a splendid idea, Ms. Vader. I'm very grateful." Before she can finish thanking Vader, Vader has walked away. She's off-screen, but her looming shadow comes back into view behind Modesty on the wall. It crosses over the painting. She's lost the opportunity to continue speaking with Vader. Modesty follows Vader off-screen. The camera pushes into the painting. On the soundtrack, the violins climb a chromatic scale and end on a minor chord. It's very mysterious. That's the end of the chapter. Do you know this movie? Tune in next time to hear the answer and a little discussion about the film.
Playing doctor and playing nurse is such fun and calls for real equipment. Everything necessary to play these parts is packed in the attractive 9.5 by 11.5 by 5-inch two-tone washable padded vinyl cases. Equipment includes thermometer, first aid supplies, pure candy pills, stethoscope, pulsometer, hypodermic, and many other items. Dolly's Nurse Kit. Young Florence Nightingales will enjoy the smart appearance of this five-piece set. Front button dress of broadcloth, light blue nurse's apron, red-lined navy blue cape, shoulder bag, and cap make up this washable set. Sizes 4 to 12. Hospital cart. This sturdy all-steel cart holds enough fascinating objects to completely dazzle young doctors and nurses. In addition to the unbreakable plasma bottle, stethoscope, forceps, thermometer, eye chart, and many other instruments, there are 4 pill jars filled with candy pills, bandages, and band-aids. In a very few words, everything needed to pull the patient through till lunchtime.
Polly had a dolly that was sick, sick, sick. So she phoned for the doctor to be quick, quick, quick. The doctor came with his bag.
Before I sign off, there's a little business to take care of. First, I want to thank very much Julie Rabatali, who gave us permission to use her excellent painting for the album art for this episode.
I misnumbered last episode's answer to the chapter and verse quiz. I said 22 and I meant 21. And I think I should just tell everybody that I used a piece of music by Randy Newman in both episode 21 and 22 called Atlantic City. And it was part of the soundtrack to Ragtime. I really love the soundtrack. I bought it on vinyl when I first saw the movie. And I think you should track it down. It's by Randy Newman, who does a lot of the Pixar movie soundtracks now. Okay, I have to apologize. I don't know why I made this wild claim that you can tell the amount of alcohol by how fast the tears or legs in a wine roll down the side of the glass. I can imagine B12 back in trying to figure this out. Really, it's a black or white thing. If you see tears, have heavy droplets that slide down the side of your glass of wine, you can assume that there's a goodly amount of alcohol in it. And if you don't see any, or they're very light, you can assume that the alcohol content is lighter. But I didn't mean to imply that there was a visual science to determining the amount of alcohol in a wine. Maybe Sherlock Holmes could do that, but so far I haven't heard of any expert that claims to be able to do this. Okay, my bad. Till next time.